I can't wait to hear what she's going to say. So without any further ado, I want to introduce Katie G.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie. I am a recovered alcoholic. Nice to see the room full. Nice to see the women. You guys there. I know you'd appreciate that. Patrick's like, bring all your friends. I've had the privilege of speaking out here before, and it was during a really bad storm, and I was the only gal here, and that was actually delightful. So it is quite an ego boost to me, trust me, to speak at a men's recovery center. I've had the gift of sobriety since October 28th of 1984. That is 4 months longer than Mr. Parker. And that was a perk. Well, it has been and still is very important to me to keep that little bit of time on him. I'll tell you guys, one of the greatest gifts about Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps is that the program of recovery, which is our 12 Steps, have given me an opportunity to get in touch with the power that gave me a new life. And that is what I want to talk about. I'll talk a little bit about my drinking, but, more than anything, my drinking, I was the youngest of three. I was born in the 50s. I'm 50 years old. I was born in 58. I was the youngest of three. I love my brothers and sisters. But, I'll tell you, how many are the babies in here? So the word torture is familiar to you, right? Torture is what happens to the baby. I mean, they all pick on you, they tease you, and, at least my experience was that I came into this world fighting. I was the fighting kid, and I always have been. I still am. I left home at a very young age. I left home at 15 and never went back and finished high school, and, I was driven. A lot of people say from the podium that they never felt like they fit in. That was not my experience. I wanted to stand out. I mean, I was loud, I was obnoxious, and I was loved by tons of people. I was voted most favorite in school. The principal called me in his office when I was really screwing up. Although I was at every principal's office, but his particular office, he would say things to me like, "Why is your car not at home?" And I said, "Well, I don't live there anymore, And he's like, "Why is your car not at home?" And it's like, "Mr. Phillips, I don't live there anymore. I can't live under the rules of my parents, and I can't do this deal." And he goes, "I'll tell you what, you don't quit school, and we'll do this thing together." And, it was remarkable. I was given a tremendous amount of breaks as a kid. It's a different day and age now, but I was given a lot of breaks. Now it's actually against the law to kick your kids out. Did you know that? I learned that because I kicked my son out. And I was shocked when I was in court that was against the law. And, of course, they are the snapping, woman that I am. But one of the things that happened early on in my childhood that I have really, really carried into, one of the things I didn't understand about alcoholism, and this is all retrospect, right? I mean, this is not what it was like out there using and drinking. I mean, this is all retrospect. Somebody offers you this and you start going, "Oh my gosh, so that, ooh. And that, it's not like when I was doing it. I knew what I was doing was burning it down. But I really didn't think there was anything terribly wrong in that. As long as I got away with it, I was a liar, a cheat. I'd steal anything that wasn't locked down, That was just the way it was as long as you didn't get caught. Well, I'm tooling along as a kid. My sister and brother are torturing the crap out of me, and they love to tease the crap out of me, and I still hate to be teased to this day, and I must have a huge tease me button, because men love to tease the shit out of me. They really do, and it makes me crazy. And one of the things is that when I was 9 years old, my mother got very, very ill and ended up passing away. And it was really sad because we were, upper middle America, and one thing leads to another. And next thing I know, she's sick. And the next day, she is dead. And back then, this was in the 60s, you know, kids weren't allowed in the hospitals. I mean, it was very, very different back then. Kids weren't allowed in the hospitals, and we had to go see her, and it was very bizarre. And then, little do I know, we're saying goodbye, and we come back to the house, and Dad says, the next day, your mother died. And 6 weeks later, he moved another woman in, and this other woman had two kids. And one was younger than me. That's a problem. And especially being a girl. You know, girls are heavily emotional, especially young. And, we never quit. But definitely young. So when this woman moved in, she only lasted a weekend. And then they were gone. And I'm thinking, I don't really quite know what's going on. Well, then 3 months later, another woman comes in. And, you know, my dad was clearly a player. Just think about that for a minute. You're like, oh. But he must have been, because, you know, he landed beautiful women. He was an ex-football player, played for the Steelers, and he was the center, so he's just this solid little guy, you know. And our house was just constantly a party house, and that's what we did. I mean, we grew up on alcohol. It was fun. And next woman he moved in was she was on the cover of Life magazine, beautiful gal, and she lasted about, you know, I guess maybe 2-3 months. And then she's gone. And then, you know, then the next one he moves in, this beautiful brunette that's a model, you know, and she's got two kids who are older. And she ends up staying. And that was when I was just done. I was done with the rules. I didn't like anything that was going down. And I left. And I started drinking at about probably 12. And, you know, that's about all I need to say. Because really, from that point on, drugs and alcohol were really my friend. I mean, they were my friend. I was into anything you got except needles. I didn't like needles. My brother did heroin. I got to experience that, and I remember being very frightened of it. I did have one guy tie me off one time, and my brother walked in the room, and it was ugly. And it was really, really very fortunate for me, because I never messed with needles. But I messed with everything else, and also got sober before crack cocaine. So having said all of that, now I want to move forward, because it's really important to know I've never done crack cocaine, and I've really worked hard at trying to sponsor people who were crackheads, and I don't get it. I really, really don't get it. I love the way Mark says, you know, I did cocaine like crazy. I mean, I did cocaine to excess, but I never went down the roads of what crack cocaine does to you. So I have found it to be quite challenging to sponsor a crackhead. Nor do I ever want to try it to find out how to sponsor. Thank you very much. I mean, wow! You know, and there's a handful of drugs I never did that I am very, very grateful for. We'll just leave it at that. So I'm touring along, right? And, you know, I'm young. I'm 15 years old when I leave the house. I don't have a car. I'm getting to school on a bicycle. I finally buy a little car. I'm working my ass off because I'm a strong-willed little gal. I got an incredible work ethic. You know, you wash and wax cars. You do whatever you got to do. You know, that was you pull yourself up from your bootstraps. You know, you get out there. We were kids of the 50s. And, you know, that was just the way it was. And I get hooked up with this guy who is quite a bit older than I am. He's 8 years older than I am. I end up living with him for 4 years, and I get pregnant. We get married, and we have this beautiful daughter, and he is just, he's a flaming alcoholic. He's got a serious drinking problem. You know, we were terrible together. And a lot of damage was done in that relationship. It never got physical, but boy, it was everything but. It was a lot of emotional damage. And so I've got this little girl, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm dragging her through everything. I'm trying to run with the largest cocaine dealers I can find, because I figured, you know, if you land the dealers, then you're set with as much cocaine as you need. And that was pretty much my goal. And I was talking to some guys earlier, Bob and his buddy. I said, you know, that was the lesson in life I learned. I can get anything I want. And it almost killed me. Because it was just a matter of, you know, figuring it out. And I don't know about you guys, but that is one of the things that has damn near kills me today in sobriety. Is because I thought all of this stuff was why I was alcoholic. All because my mother died and my father remarried and all these people moving in and yada, 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 yada. And when I finally come into this program, I realize that alcoholism is a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And I'm thinking, well, I mean, that might be for some of you guys in the room, but, you know, I mean, I just got serious problems. If you can just get me off the cocaine, the alcohol is fine. Don't be touching my alcohol. I got no idea. No, thank you. I'm loving the alcohol, raising a family where alcohol flowed. No, thank you. Well, this chick said something to me. She said two things, actually. She said, when you drink alcohol, you feel in control. When the non-alcoholic drinks alcohol, they feel out of control. Now, I don't know about you guys, but you know what? When you're one day sober, that's I need it that simple. You know, it's a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And what happens with that physical allergy is it kicks in, you know, the physical allergy, one's not enough, 1,000 things you mentioned, you got mental obsession, you got to, you know, and you're like, on. You know, I just want you guys to kind of help me here, okay? You know, I mean, we tend to lose sight what the new guy can hear. You know, the new guy's just thinking, I love Earl Hightower does that whole thing where it's like, lay the keys down. Okay, guy in the red jacket over there. Okay, they're saying something. I don't know what they're saying. Okay. You know, the new guy's head is about ready to blow off. I mean, do you guys remember your first meeting? A word spoken in your first meeting? No, I don't. I remember sitting there thinking the guy next to me was cute. I do remember that. That is a cute guy next to me. I mean, I don't know. I came in at Halloween, October 28th, and I was dressed as Tina Turner the night before. And that is a whole other story. I had not showered or anything, and I had the gold hair. You got to kind of keep in mind it was the 80s, and that thing was towering to the left, you know. And when they asked at the meeting if anybody was new, I kid you not, the room went like this. But I really do want to fast forward to recovery, because that to me is the greatest gift in the whole wide world, guys. I had to learn how to do it all over, and I am still learning today. And I don't know about y'all, but man, I am loaded with pride. I am loaded with pride and ego. I mean, and even, you know, Charlie will say, you know, since Mark's his sponsor, he'll go, well, I'd like to know if I have the path of consideration. And I'm thinking, no, you do not have the path of consideration right now. You know, and the truth is he's right on the money with what he's saying. But I am like, I don't want to hear it, you know? And that is my default setting in life was screw you. It always was. Don't tell me anything. My pride just kills me. But one of the things I wanted to say is when I'm doing long, I get sober. I have actually the guy that was sitting to my right was so darn cute, we end up getting married. And see, I feel like I can get just about anything I want. And I'm a pretty convincing little gal. And he had 6 years sober, and I had 10 minutes. And the deal worked. And it was a bumpy road, though, let me tell you. It was a very, very bumpy road. I don't recommend it. However, I won't discourage it either. You know, if you get me as your sponsor, I won't discourage it. Because the book tells me on page 69, I don't get to really tell you. I can get you in touch with a power greater than yourself that can give you some direction. But I don't know who's best for you and who's not. And I'm very, very grateful at that time that somebody didn't, because we were married 20 years until he passed away. But we did. Oh, we had a heck of a road. And he was a big book thumping fool. And now another thing that happened to me is I cheated all the way through school. I mean, I graduated. My God, I couldn't understand people dropping out of school. Now, you got to keep in mind, it was the late 60s, early 70s, and it was like, why would you work this hard to get this far to drop out? And it was mainly the boys. The boys were dropping out like flies. And, you know, they had to wear a wig to school. Remember all that? You know, remember the two paper joints and, you know, God, those were the days, weren't they? But, so, you know, they you know, I just thought, I don't get it, you guys. I am graduating from high school. I am walking down that thing. I am going to have some success here. You know, like I said, I'm a very driven gal, but I cheated all the way through school. And I'm not talking mildly cheated. I broke into school to change papers, figured out that I could get people to pay me to do it so I could buy my pot, Because, you know, you could steal beer from, you know, alcohol from mom and dad. As a matter of fact, I didn't drink beer. I mean, we had so much hard liquor. But the pot, I needed money for pot. And so, you know, I'd say, look, you know, I know a way that I can change your grades. Because back then, there was no computers or anything. It was all done in pencil and a little grade book. And I had people just shoveling money at me. And I always knew I was an entrepreneur. You know, I've been self-employed for 26 years. I've done very well there too. But when I came in this program, they handed me a book. That was bad news. That was bad news, man. I don't read well. I can read, but I can't comprehend. Does anyone know what I'm saying? You know, somebody says, "Well, read, you know, this chapter," and you're like, after a page, I don't understand a word I just read. You know, I can't even stay focused. And so that was not good news. The other bad news was that I was going to have a spiritual experience. That was bad news. So I'm sitting there in that meeting thinking, well, we'll just see what happens. We like this guy. He's very cute. And we'll just get him to be God. And that'll work great. And it really did work well. And it worked well for some time. So he read me the big book, and I did get a sponsor, we read the book together, and it's so funny when we get together in AA, you know, isn't it funny to watch them get together in AA? Oh, boy. So, what do they call it, the bed of mental health is where we're coming in to pick our soulmate. So we get together. I got a 5-year-old daughter who is crazy in love with this guy. He moves in, and it's like, well, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? Are you going to get a job, you know, at some point? And I'm still doing my career, which has been in fitness. It always has been. And he's not getting a job, and he finally gets a job. And the next thing you know, we're given tons of gifts in this program. And this was my story. My story is that at 3 years sober, the gifts were so incredibly good in AA that I took a turn. You know where it says we stood at the turning point? Either God was or He wasn't. We said He was. We'll go to church. Now, for me to even go to church was a big deal. Because, you know, I was raised Catholic. I didn't really have anything against the church. I just didn't like it. You know, it's just like, what in the hell, fire, brimstone? I just didn't like it. Well, he went to church. We went to this non-denominational, you know, the band's out. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. And I thought, well, I kind of did this. This is kind of cool. Well, needless to say, you know, I found Jesus. And it's scary for an alcoholic to find Jesus. Let me tell you, because I want everybody to find Jesus just like I wanted everybody to find AA. So we found Jesus, and I couldn't run Charlie off. You know, Charlie and I were best friends. We were like brother and sister. There was never any sexual nothing, because that wasn't what I didn't play that game. One of the greatest gifts I got early on in sobriety was integrity. And that is a gift, guys. That's one of the things I love about Mark Houston's place out here, is you guys, you put on that you've got a lot of integrity. Personally, I think you do. You may do a lot of the boy play games, but you do come off with a tremendous amount of integrity, and I love that. I love that in life. I you know, for us drunks to feel okay in our own skin anywhere is a gift that only God can give you. So we took off into the church thing for about 3 years. I'm about three to five years sober with Joe, and he's, you know, 15 years, whatever, 6 years more than me, always 11 years. And we start getting crazy, really crazy. And all of a sudden, man, this deal's not working anymore. We're resenting the crap out of church. You know, it is, none of it's working. And we used to say we were knee-deep in church, and that was going on Sunday. We were big involved. We go on Sunday. You know, we would think we were, you know, going to the luncheons and the, you know, campouts and the revivals, and no, we were just going on Sunday, but that was big. And you can see pictures of us, and it was scary. I mean, we looked like, we just looked perfect. We looked Christian. And it was, I have those pictures, and I look at them, and I just think, you know, we alcoholics are chameleons. You know what I mean? I mean, we don't even know. We suffer from a disease of delusion that I don't even know I'm in it. You know? And without somebody there, That's bad news, guys, bad news. So when we get through the Christian days, I am sitting there. I still love Jesus today, but, you know, that's about as far as that goes. Or I'm sitting at a red light, and this woman is not taking a right on red, and now I'm about to ram her into the traffic, you know. And it was insane. And Joe and I talked, and we both said we got to go back to AA. And we went back in, and Ed Hasbrook was speaking. And, oh, my God, I just leaned over, and I said, we're home. We're home. But what happened at that point was, now we're at about 7 to 8, 9 years for me, Joseph, you know, 17. What we realized happened, and this is once again hindsight. Everything is hindsight. You do realize that. Everything is hindsight. I don't know the future. I know the past, and I can learn from the past. Is that we came back into AA, and the one thing I noticed that was bizarre was a lot of chanting. A lot of that God could and would if he were soft chanting, and you know, keep coming back, it works if you work because you're worth it, and you're worth it, and you're worth it, and you're worth it. Sort of do the hokey pokey, you know, and I thought, what the hell, is this summer camp or what? And then, the other thing I noticed was everybody started shaking hands, and there was no hugging, none, no hugging. And I thought, what is it? Hello, it's very nice to meet you. Very nice to meet you. And people say, well, it's because some of the men were predators. We've convinced you that you're the predator, haven't we? Very interesting. Moving on. So, you know, so one of the things that I so Joe and I, you know, we didn't know this, but we at that point realized that we were missing meetings. That's what it was. It was meetings. Never, ever did it occur to us that it was the book. He was a big book thumping fool. I mean, he bugged the crud out of you in a meeting. We never opened the book, nothing. He read a lot out of the Bible, and we went to meetings. And I'm telling you, that is the first thing in the world. And if you think AA meetings are a solution for alcoholism, you are missing the boat. That does not say don't go to meetings. As a matter of fact, I never even said don't go to meetings. I said if you're using meetings to treat alcoholism, it'll work right up to the point you drink. And you'll go, what happened? And what's the first thing somebody says when you're hurting? Go to a meeting. It's like, no, pick up the book. See, this is the spiritual guide that will help you. We missed that. Now, it was no one's fault we missed that. I'm just telling you my experience. So, and this book is really of no avail without somebody teaching it to me. But hey, man, it's a better beginning than going to a meeting, right? Especially an open discussion meeting in this day and age. You know, it is so, how was your day? And you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, I almost died sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was no one's fault. I am never, ever blaming anybody. But if I can tell you today that these rooms are full of untreated alcoholism, they are full of untreated alcoholism. And us guys that have got a lot of time are dying. Because we're not going to be here for the new guy. You know, everybody says the new guy's the most important. I go, oh, hell no. If we don't take care of the old guy, there's not going to be anybody for the new guy. It's going to be treatment. You know, treatment again is no recovery for alcoholism. I mean, how many people have been in treatment never touched the steps? Oh, you know, I can just get on such a bandwagon. So, and trust me, I got 34 minutes, I just might. So, but I'm here to tell you now. Now, here's the tricky part, guys. The tricky part is you won't even know you're in it. Here's my finger, Mary Jo. You won't even know you're in it. Okay? So don't think, well, that's not going to happen to me. And no, I'm knee-deep, I'm this, I'm that. No, you won't even know. That's what delusion means. So you don't even know you're in it. I didn't know I was in it. I didn't know that the meetings weren't going to do it. You know, and another thing that makes me crazy in this program, and I know I'm sitting in a room full of people who have chronic relapse. I did not have chronic relapse, so I am speaking out of an experience I do not know. But I can tell you from an experience of someone who did not relapse, you don't have to relapse to get it. Okay, that's bullshit. That, you know why that's bullshit? Because I think you feel so goddamn guilty and full of shame. And that's all I can assume. That's an assumption on my part. But I do have to tell you, I ran into this chick yesterday. I do a lot of work at one of the treatment centers, and this girl saw me, and she was all excited to see me at the grocery store, you know, and I said, "How you doing?" And she said, "I'm doing good. You know, when I left, I went out one more time, and I had to. I just had to." I thought, oh, great, we're on the spaghetti aisle, you know. And I go, and you know, that's when you kind of move in, because you're like going, holy crap, you know, we're in the grocery store here, you know. And you know, you new guys in recovery, you talk loud, you know. And she goes, "No, I had to, you almost died." And she's going on and on and on, and she said, "That was when I saw the light." And I thought, you almost died, you know? No, that's not how my God works. You don't almost have to die to get it. You almost die because you're full of self-will. It's that simple. It says it all in the book. You got self-will or God's will. You know, He's throwing you 110 life rafts, and you're just swimming upstream. Don't need that one. No. I'll go this way. And so by the time she finished, I said, she goes, "So, I saw the light. I realized it." And I said, "You got a sponsor?" And she goes, "Well." I said, "Are you working the steps?" "Well." I said, "Well, let me tell you, that near-death experience you had will not hold you. The book says you won't be able to remember a week or a month ago the pain and suffering. You won't remember that you were laying there almost dying." See, that's delusion, guys. That's what delusion is. It's not denial. The book never speaks of denial. It's all delusion. So, and then by, not to mention, she had way too much perfume on. Oh. At one point, I thought, oh, for God's sakes, work the steps and cut back on some of that perfume. Man, we got to start with baby steps. You know what I'm saying? Baby steps. So, one of the things is that when I got back, okay, so here comes the perfect storm. So I'm knee-deep in untreated alcoholism. Now, once again, you can run on untreated alcoholism for a long time. I mean a long time, up until you drink. And what will usually happen is, if this has been my experience watching it and also my experience, is that you have, say you're tooling along, you're just doing meetings, you don't sponsor anybody, you got some of the gifts going on, yada, 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 life sucks. But, you know, today, this is what I said to myself. I don't want to drink and use today. So I'm not. Like, I've got some power there. I mean, God removed the drink and drug problem. I got the gifts of sobriety. Back up, big boy. That's all I wanted was power. Now I just want to go through life without the drugs and alcohol, because that's my problem. Even though the book says it's not my problem. You know what my problem is? Page 62. It says, "Selfish and self-centered, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity." See, and I had that every day. And that was the problem, was I just had to figure out how to go at it again. My default setting with the problem is, how can I fix this? Give me a little bit of time. I'll fix it. I'm good. So I can get anything I want in life. And then when it really gets bad, I go, okay, big boy, come on back in. Come on. Okay, I'll hit my knees. This stuff's really getting bad here, God. Give me a direction. Then all of a sudden I think, got an idea. Let's do something. God's idea. There it is. That's all I needed. Ding. You know, because my default setting is fix it. How many of you guys know what I mean? If you don't have enough money in the bank, oh, come on, bring in God. It could take forever. I've got to sit here and figure out what I can sell, who I can ask. And then it says, "Then we step on the toes of our fellows. They retaliate, seeming without provocation, because they're done with us. They are so done with us." And we keep going back for the same old, same old. Maybe you have an enabler in your life. And so, once again, and you know, that's the worst thing in the world for an alcoholic, an enabler. And I do want to say, you need to stop. Yes? You got an enabler? You need to stop. Don't expect them to stop. They're as sick as we are. You know, they keep throwing money at us and whatever else, you know. And one of the things, guys, that for the new guy, and this is clearly an observation on my part. You don't know what's best for you. You don't know what direction to take. And you don't really have a God of your understanding enough to make those big decisions. That's why everything must be run past your sponsor, no matter how small or stupid. Right? Everything. When I hit that spot in recovery, which I meant to say when I was in untreated alcoholism, all it was going to take was the root canal, or I needed surgery for my knee. And then you have to have some Vicodin. Absolutely. How much Vicodin can you give me? Right? And then the next thing you know, I'm off on pills, and then I'm drinking again. Because see, I got the spiritual malady is eating my lunch. I'm shoving sex in it. I'm shoving kids in it. I'm shoving work in it. I'm shoving everything I can shove in it. And then all of a sudden, you give me that dope. Whoo! That's what I was looking for. That's that restless cerebral discontent, right? And then the next thing you know, somebody goes, what happened? I mean, wouldn't it really just shock the dickens out of you guys if you heard Charlie or I slipped? Absolutely. Are we capable of that? You bet. You bet. You know, I'm telling you what, we've been given a second chance in this program, and I tell my sponsor, the minute you see me off the beam, you ride my ass, man. I don't even want to get close to that edge ever again. You know, I have given her the okay. I've given actually a handful of people the okay. You know, and when you come at me, I'm gonna be fighting you too. You know what I mean? I'm not gonna go, you're right. Oh yeah, wow. Okay. I'm back. No, I'm gonna be fighting you all the way. But one of the things, guys, is we've got, I love this line in the book. It's on page 20. And I know I'm skipping all over the place, but I don't care. You're getting plenty out of it. You know what I mean? You can skip all over. That's the beauty of spiritual literature. You can just go all over the place. You're like, oh, I like that. Oh, I like that. Oh, I'm not sure about that. Okay, I like that. I like that. So page 20, it says, and this is page 20. This is before you've really done anything other than the fact that you've kind of looked at the fact that you're restless, irritable, and discontent, and some doctor has an opinion about something. Okay. And it says, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Is that even where you are today? I mean, I remember the first time I heard that, I went, oh, shut up. Come on. This is all about me being a better person and seeing what I can bring to the world. Me. Right? It's like the constant thought of others is not my default setting, guys. I am my default setting. I mean, how many of you guys see something and you know, in a line, and you go, oh man, there's five people ahead of me and they ain't going to be there and they've got to figure out how to get in front of them. Get in front of them. Okay. There's enough for me now. I mean, all I think about is me. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you guys know that feeling when you're in that complete surrender, which I don't know how to get you there, honestly. I don't know how I get there, because I know that, I mean, I have to be bludgeoned and laying in, as my sponsor says, in the fetal position, pulling my eyelashes out before I go, I'm done, I can't take any more pain. And that doesn't mean alcohol and drugs. That can be a relationship, that can be money, that can be the kids, it can be anything. I have to be beat into submission of pain that is unbearable. And then I'm at a surrender until I get a little control. Then I don't need God anymore. And I don't even know I'm doing this. Right? See, that's the part that gets me is, you know, when somebody comes to you, when you call your sponsor with the same thing after a year, you're like, God's not listening to me, but you know what that's about? God's so listening to you. He says, I can't do anything because you are at a surrender. I go, what the heck does that look like? And he goes, change. That means you might have to stop looking at the porn. That means you might have to quit spending. I know that always feels good in a men's meeting. And you guys seem to like it more than we women do, but it goes both ways. And it means you got to stop spending your money. if you have a financial problem. That means you have to show up when you don't want to show up. Okay? See, that's why God's not answering that prayer, is because you're not giving it. I call it the drunk prayer. You know, how many of y'all remember the drunk prayer? Oh, I swear to God, God, get me through this. Oh, God, I feel terrible. Just get me through today, I'll be fine. Well, that same prayer is the prayer I pray. And I'm not willing to give it up. I'm not willing to change. Just get me through this hurt, and then I'll fix it. Then I'll get there. And that is what really, really eats my lunch today. Okay, so I'm going to move on. So the constant thought of others, just keep that in the back of your mind. Okay? I love this line. This is all the third step. The third step is, I love the 12 and 12. And it's the book that when you've got longer sobriety, you really, personally, I don't think you should touch it until you've got a few years of sobriety. The basic text is what you should always work out of. But I love the 12 and 12. Why I got to say that stupid line is to keep some of you off my back. But the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Well, I don't know about you guys, but that is all I ran on, was self-will. I mean, that's all I ever did was self-will. I can climb the highest mountain in business. How many of you guys have done incredibly well in sobriety? You reach the pinnacle. It's like, this is kind of boring. Okay, my sponsor says this, let's just throw a grenade and really cause some trouble. You know, and she goes, you know, Katie, when things go great for you, you throw that grenade just to stir it up. I don't even know I'm doing it because I suffer from a disease of delusion. I don't even know how to do success. Self-centered fear is all good, all bad. I'm afraid of getting the guy. I'm afraid of not getting the guy. I'm afraid of getting the job. I'm afraid of not getting the job. It's everything. Self-centered fear is in the seventh step in the 12 and 12. It's beautifully explained. So it says that the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. So the book's telling me I can't even trust my motives. Oh, so that means I got to live on principles. I know you guys out here, principles are beat into you. They're principles of integrity. You're a person of your word. You don't lie, you don't cheat, you don't steal. That's the basic what we got to start out with. And if we don't lie, cheat, and steal, we think we're doing pretty damn good. But we jump in our car without car insurance. We don't have an inspection sticker on our car. Well, at least I'm not lying, cheating, and stealing. You know what I mean? And I mean, what we try to push that edge and get away with is the part that makes us crazy, that eats our lunch, and that's what brings us back to the drink. So we come back over here, and I love this part. You know, it says, and it's talking about what usually happens here, is that I go into angry, indignant, and self-pity when I, you know, you might be a little bit at fault, but you're not. I'm not completely at fault here. So I'm going to get angry, and then indignant is that part where, you know what? I've done plenty for you people. Look what I've done. I mean, anybody that would leave this recovery center out of here would be living in 60 to 63, right? And I mean, you could make a case for it. You could make a case for walking out of AA. That AA treated you wrong. Wrong. And one of the things that we tend to do that is the part of the delusion of this disease is the line where it says they may be somewhat at fault. But surely, you know, excuse me, I may be somewhat at fault, but surely they are to blame. See, if you get anybody in AA co-signing that bullshit, man, run as fast as you can. Because that is going to throw you down. You have got to get somebody that says, whoa, let's try to figure out where did you set the ball rolling? Where did you place yourself in a position to be hurt? Let's try to figure out your part. I don't want anybody in this program to go, what a bitch. I don't blame you for hating her. I'd hate her too. Says resentment's the number one offender. It'll kill me. And the way it kills me is I go back to using. Then I destroy everybody's life. Oh, it's heartbreaking. It says, is he not a victim of the delusion that you can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if you only manage well? See, and the word wrest is not R-E-S-T, it's W-R-E-S-T, which means violent twist or seized by force. I mean, how many of you guys have just, you know, I always love it, the way I look at it, how many of y'all have kids? How many have said this on a family vacation? By God, we are going to have fun if it kills me. That's pretty normal on a family vacation. That's the same concept that we're taking in life. By God, I will get what I need to get happy. Get your ass out of my way. If I just had one employee out of here. Or you're out here and all of a sudden, you know, you're in this hopeless despair, that drowning man that the book talks about, right? And all of a sudden you come out to Mark Houston's Recovery Center, man, you'll go anywhere. Oh, I got in. Okay, it's great. And then all of a sudden you go, you're going to hook me up in the room with this guy? I'm really happy about that. Then you know, and I got to do what? You want me to clean that floor? Now hold on just a minute. I'm the client here. I paid for money. See what I'm saying? I mean, you went from that desperation of a drowning man and that ego, poof, popped its head right up, and that's what's going to kill you. See, it's a disease of self. It's not the drugs and alcohol. If it were, when you get out of here and you've got 90 days clean, you should have no problem. The only problem is you rest served by discontent, so you go back into that whole squirrel cage, see? So that's the deal, is watch how irritable you get and how you forget the week or a month ago of the pain and suffering. See, that's what we do, is we forget. And oh, God dang, I'm so right there with you. Don't think I'm not. Well, so we flip over, we're talking about that selfish and self-centered, that we think is the root of our troubles. Now, we are driven by 100 forms of fear. Now, guys, what that looks like for me, and let me tell you, if I didn't have the gift of working with sponsees, and it is a gift, it works when nothing else will. The book guarantees me of that. Now, trust me, it won't work by itself. You have to do the disciplines of 10-11. Because if you just try sponsoring people and you do the first step and the 12th step, it will not work. Right? You have to do those disciplines. There's two things I want to say about this when we're talking about fear. The dishonesty that you're telling yourself is the same dishonesty I'm telling myself. There's three levels of dishonesty. The flat-out lie, which is what I thought I lived in. I thought dishonesty meant, did I lie? And I'd go, no. You know, move on. It's the flat-out lie. It's sin by omission, right, which means leaving it out. I just didn't tell you the whole truth. Right? And then the third one is delusion. Is that I actually believe that I'll be okay if I don't do prayer and meditation today. Okay, well, shoot, I didn't get to do prayer and meditation tomorrow. Okay, you know what? That's okay. I know the book tells me I got to have it. I'll get it on day 3. Okay, well, I didn't get it on day 3. See, that is the delusion of the dishonesty, is that I can be okay in AA and not work these steps. That's dishonest, right? When it says I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, that could be the fear of financial insecurity. I love the way Charlie explains it. You're in like a limousine, beautiful vehicle, right? You know, life's doing pretty good. Got your job back, got your wife back, got your kids back. Parents are letting you come on over to the picnic. It's all good. And all of a sudden, you got some financial fear. So the chauffeur goes, today, we're going to have financial fear. Now, you sit back there behind that glass, and it's all going to be fine. And you're in the back seat of that car just crazy while that car is driving you, right? We're going to have insecurity today. There you go. We're going to have all self-seeking. There you go. You're going to want to go out there and just fix the world, change the world, because you are driven by the fear. That's all that part where they talk about. Because when they say selfish and self-centered is the root, that is the root. These are just the branches that are poking you in the eye. The employee at work, the money problems, the kids. Oh, the children. I swear, you guys, once you have children, you will see your parents totally different. You know how your parents always told you that? Oh, my God. My 19-year-old, well, there you're sitting right there. That boy looks just like my son. I told him, I said, how old are you? He goes, 19. I went, I'm old enough to be your mother. Let's just sit with that for a moment. Okay. My son could be sitting in a recovery center, too. I'm telling you, it's a good day today. So, it says that we do self-delusion. So, see, let's just say This is my favorite example. You're sitting, say this happened tonight. All of a sudden, two people are talking, they whisper, and they look over at you. They start whispering again to you. What? They talking about me? Did they say something about me? Then you go, oh, I know what they're talking about. Oh, yeah, okay. That's fine. And then before you know it, man, that thing starts ticking. Yeah. Now, this is all based on just this. Oh, yeah. I am 9 miles down the road, and I better go tell four people that what they were talking about is bullshit. I had nothing to do with that. Nothing. Okay, see, so that's that self-seeking. I got to put the fire out because I saw them looking at me and I know what they were saying. And so, see, that's the part. You're driven by fear that you're thinking about you, that someone's talking about you. What if they were looking at the person behind you? Said, hey, man, check out that guy that's got that nice motorcycle. And that was it. You know what I mean? But, well, not us. Not us alcoholics, man. They were talking about me. Or say Mark walks out of his office and he looks at you and goes, just walks on. What was that? What was that? That mean? What the hell did that mean? You know? And I mean, we take that to a level that is self-will run riot. You got two guys fighting? That's a regular fight. You got a riot? That's a scary place to be. Right? That's when they say self-will run riot, we'll wind this thing up so tight. Then we get into that self-seeking, and then it always turns into self-pity because we're 99% of the time wrong, right? And that's just, I mean, how many times are we wrong? Always. Always. But I still believe the lie of the delusion. That's the part that gets me. So I want you guys to realize that when we're talking about the third step, one of the things I love in the 12 and 12, because the third step really, for y'all that are out here, I know you work all the way through the steps and everything, but you got to keep going back to that third step. Because I go back to that third step every day. Every day, every day, every day. I love this in the 12 and 12. It says, like all the remaining steps, step 3 calls for affirmative action. For it is only by action that we can cut away the self-will which has always blocked the entry of God. Or, if you like, a higher power into our lives. Faith, to be sure, is necessary. But our faith alone can avail nothing. See, I always loved this part. And I never got that whole faith thing. We can have faith, yet keep God out. And that's what I did. See, I was like, thank you so much for taking that dope problem away and that dream. Yeah. I got it from here, man. Thanks, dude. You know? And then I am off and running. And successfully, I might add. Therefore, our problem now becomes just how and by what specific means shall we be able to let him in. Step 3 represents our first attempt, which means we got a whole lot more, to do this. In fact, the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. See, that's what it always comes back to for me. I want to kind of wrap this whole deal up. Because 60 to 63, and we agnostics, was where I had to live for a long time and still do. I had to get the we agnostics because I didn't get God. I needed the book to tell me all I needed was that much God and I was going to be okay. See, I thought I had to have that much God to be okay. I just need that much God to begin this process. I mean, the doors fly open. You guys have experienced that. I know everybody in this room has. There's one thing I have to do, and this is the deal. Blind Dave always talks about it. I love it. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we have to quit playing God. That is a tough order, guys. That one right there. It may be a few words, and it's huge. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He's the principal, we're his agent. He's the father, we are his children. Most good ideas are simple. That sounds simple till somebody pisses me off. Okay? That's all it takes. You know, you piss me off, you do me wrong, watch out. I throw all those principles out the window. And this concept was the keystone of our new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer being all-powerful. He provided what we needed. Now here's the only thing you got to do, and it's big. We have to keep close to him, which means we have to do 10 and 11. Of course, we clear away all of our stuff, right? We do 4 through 9, but everybody wants to repeat 4 through 9. And you know why you want to do it? Same reason I wanted to do it. More information about Katie, so Katie can run the show. Just tell me a little bit more about how I operate, because I really need to get to the top of that mountain. You know, my default setting was not prayer. My default setting was good. Get out of my way. Okay, now I see. So I'll just charm the pants off of them. I'll just do that. Right? I mean, I stood out. I was most likable. Freshman favorite, sophomore favorite, princess, queen. You name it, I rode on the parade. Completely full of value. It was really fun. That was when it was so fun. It really, really was fun to have the band behind you. All of a sudden, you know, the band is behind me, and I thought, what? And they started playing. It's like, woo! Oh! My God, that was a fun day. It really was. You can see the pictures. But, and that was when it was still fun, right? So it was really something. But so we have to stay close to him and perform his work well. So perform his work well means I have got to carry the message, period. You do not get to not sponsor, period. You do not get to sponsor, period. Take the pressure off of me, for God's sake. So I want to tell you one of the things about sponsorship, and then I'm going to wrap it up. So you don't get to not sponsor. Did I already make that point clear? Yeah, you don't get to not sponsor because two reasons. It's too much work for me. Reason number one, right? Reason number two, the gifts are unbelievable. The 12-step promises in the book, this is what they say, and then I'm going to end it with this one, because some of y'all are giving me the stink eye. You're giving me the label. You're still talking like, oh yeah, I'm picking up on it. Yeah. Selfish and self-centered, this is all about me right now. Okay, page 89, I love it. It says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intense, doesn't say light work, doesn't say you only get to sponsor one person. It says intense work with other alcoholics. It works when all activities fail, which means prayer and meditation. How many of you guys have ever broke up with somebody you love and prayer and meditation ain't working? Oh, it's not going to work either, because your head won't shut up. You've got to go find a drunk and listen to that nonsense. Oh, my God. I am not kidding. This Charlie and I broke up 100 times, and I grabbed this one little drunk girl, and I swear at one point I would talk to my sponsor and go, I just hate him. Okay. So, listen. Let's pull out your book. Let's do the steps. Okay, hold on. And she's like, you know, and I'm thinking, just bear with me, man. We're going to make it through this. And she's thinking, just want to get sober, darling. Just want to get sober. Says, it works when all other activities fail. This is the 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics, ! So one of the things is, you know, I sponsor a lot of gals. I sponsor probably too many. And one of the things is this one chick calls me. It's a really bizarre, it's a great story because you got to hear it. She calls, yeah, go ahead, you couple of people who are not enjoying this right now. She calls on our home line. I answer the home phone, this is what she says. Is this Charlie Parker's house? Oh, that's never good. I'm like, why, yes it is. Lucky me, I'm glad I got this call. And you would be? And she says, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. I understand that you're the girl that needs to sponsor me. And I thought, I don't get too many people. I don't want to sponsor this chick. Well, we start talking, and I clearly begin to see that I got to at least talk to her, right? I'm not going to sponsor, but I'll at least talk to her. Well, the next thing you know, we have this incredible phone relationship. We could have stood next to each other at Randall's and I wouldn't have known who she was. But she has told me her entire life. Because the book tells me, you take one drunk and we can win the confidence of another, right? We get this incredible relationship going over the phone. And at one point I got pissed off at her, and I've been known to do that. You know, I said, let me tell you something. You know, you have now taken up about 6 hours of my life, and I don't know you. I could stand next to you in the grocery store, and we would not know one another. So either we're going to do this deal, or we're not going to do this deal. She's like, I'm willing to do this deal. Well, we finally get together to do this inventory process, third step prayer, all of that stuff, she had had a horrific child death. Horrific. One of her children died. It was terrible. My husband had passed away, and it was horrible. And I'm sitting there with her, and she is reliving my life, guys. You know the third step prayer where it says, take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to someone I help. It doesn't say take away my difficulties so my life gets better. It says so I can help someone else. All of a sudden, she's telling me this gut-wrenching pain. This child's been dead for 3 years. She's telling me stuff I haven't felt in 2 years. I've forgotten. I hadn't even felt it in 2 years. But that was what had me under the bed pulling my eyelashes out. You know? And I'm sitting there going, I burst into tears. And she's like, and I went, oh my God, I am living the third step promises. This is what it's about. That's why you call our home line. That's why you and I are working together right now. I see the miracle. Is A, I get to carry you through this pain and anguish. She hasn't been able to stay sober. I'm not giving myself credit for getting her sober. But I'll tell you what. You talk about two people who can relate. Is when you have that kind of level of grief, you need someone. Because we alcoholics, we fly that flag of uniqueness. No one can touch me because I'm different. Right? My problems are different. So it has been an incredible, incredible journey with this gal. But when you get to work with another drunk and you get to experience that gift, guys, it is remarkable. I normally end with this really cool thing about paradox, and I took it out of my book. So I just want to say, damn it. Damn it. Oh, it always ends on such a good little note. But what I want to tell you is, there are miracles in this program that you will miss because you suffer from the disease that I suffer from. It's a disease of delusion and self. And if you don't stay closely connected with the roots of all of us, that's why we do this thing with Unity, man. You'll be given the same promise as the book tells you. You will have a miserable existence. So I really, really encourage you guys to stay connected. Thanks.